Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Lynn Coop, host of the Blue Plate Special. And tonight on the menu, we have yet another Anthony Award-nominated writer. Eric Buettner has been described as the James Brown of noir, the hardest-working man in crime fiction, and the 21st century's answer to Jim Thompson. Along with the McGraw family crime novels, Rum Runners and the Anthony-nominated Leadfoot, Buettner has written several novels, novellas, and short stories. He was a 2017 International Thriller Award nominee and two-time 2017 Anthony Award nominee for Best Paperback Original and Best Anthology for Unloaded, which we'll be talking more about later. Eric co-hosts the podcast Writer Types along with Steve Loudon and hosts the popular Noir at the Bar reading series in Los Angeles. When not writing, he lives and works in LA where he edits and produces TV shows, saying that he's part of the problem that people don't read as much as they used to. How you doing, Eric?
Very well. Thank you for having me, Terry.
Congratulations on these Anthony Award nominations. That is just absolutely superb. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Down and Out books, which is the McGraw crime family series?
Yeah, so Leadfoot is the book that was nominated for an Anthony in the Best Paperback Original category, which I was very grateful to receive. And it's the second in this series, but it's actually a prequel. So people, you know, always want to know, do I have to read the first book first? And this is a case where you kind of can pick it up with either one. Rum Runners was written first, but actually takes place after. Both books center around this family in rural Iowa who have made their little niche in the crime underworld being drivers for a crime family who sort of handles all of the, you know, the day-to-day godfather type stuff. And the McGraws just get behind the wheel and they go where they're told and do what they're asked to do. If it has to do with an engine, they'll take care of it. And it's this kind of multi-generational saga of this family and all of the trouble they get into from behind the wheel.
So to make sure, Leadfoot happens before Rum Runners.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Rum Runners came out with a different publisher coming up on 3 years ago now, I guess. And the basic story of that was one of the McGraws is in his 60s. He is still driving. His son Tucker doesn't want anything to do with the business. So Tucker sells insurance. He goes the complete opposite way of the criminal life. But then when his dad goes missing while on a job, he sets out to find out what happened to him, and he has no other choice but to enlist the help of his grandfather, the original McGraw, Calvin, who started in the family business. So now the grandfather and the grandson, you know, one who lived this criminal life and one who wants nothing to do with it, have to team up to find the generation in the middle. And out of that book, Rum Runners, Calvin, who, you know, is in his 80s in Rum Runners, really kind of was the breakout character. People really, I got a lot of emails and discussions with people that they really liked Calvin. So when I was talking with the publisher about plans to do more, I had outlines for a trilogy going forward, and they actually suggested, hey, would you think about maybe a prequel? And I just got really excited about the idea because it gave me a chance to push Calvin front and center. And so I went back to the early 70s when Calvin is sort of in his prime. And then Webb McGraw, the guy who goes missing in Rum Runners, is actually just, you know, 20 years old and is about to head out on his very first job in the family business. So that's what happens in Leadfoot.
That sounds fascinating. And I have to ask, because it's a personal love of mine, in Leadfoot, do they drive really cool cars?
They do. You know, it was a lot of fun to research. You know, because in Rum Runners, it's funny. You think about people who drive, and immediately people's minds go to, I think, a lot of classic movies. You know, you've got Bullet, and you've got Smokey and the Bandit, and you've got all these sort of car-centric films that were really hot in the sort of 70s and 80s. But even when you think about it, and they'll do it today, like if you put someone in a chase scene today, chances are they're actually going to be driving a vintage muscle car. So I got to write about a lot of those, you know, old Mustangs and, you know, Calvin in Rum Runners, Calvin drives an old, you know, Pontiac Firebird, like, a, you know, the Burt Reynolds Smoking the Bandit car. There's a big subplot around the Superbird Roadrunner. I don't know if you know this car. It's, yeah, with that giant ridiculous fin on the back of it. And, you know, so I had a chance to then go back to the actual 70s when all these cars were new, and I don't do a tremendous amount of research for any of my books. I just prefer to make stuff up. But for the cars, it's one of those things where if you get something wrong, people will let you know. So I did research
will let you know if you get them wrong, yes.
Well, so I did my due diligence. The model years and all the technology is correct for the early 70s.
When I was writing my book, a 1971 Challenger plays into the plot line, and that, of course, is my homage to Vanishing Point. I actually went through and made sure that, you know, there was an option for leather seats in 1971, that sort of thing, for the exact same reason. That type of stuff has to be. I think you have to get the cars right better than you have to get the guns right.
It's true. People have strong opinions.
Well, I mean, so this is a bunch of 70s bandits and muscle cars in Iowa in the 70s. I love this. So
yeah, it was a fun sandbox to play in.
And where are they in Iowa?
They're sort of southeastern, kind of Johnson County. I don't really specify too many exact towns, but mm-hmm. I was born in Iowa City, and mm-hmm. my father and my grandparents were from Burlington and Fort Madison, so I know that area well, and I think it's the kind of place that virtually never gets written about at all. So I think it's interesting to set books in you know, new and different places, because on one level, you know, Southeast Iowa is just as exotic as, you know, Thailand if you've never been there. So why not?
I live in Southeast Kansas, so I concur. I absolutely concur on that. No, it actually does sound like it's just a heck of a good time, because the movie Dirty Mary and Crazy Larry, that was actually filmed in the town where I went to high school. That grocery store that they rob right at the beginning of the movie, that's where we all shopped. So that was, you know, yes, I was raised in a musclehead family, so I definitely love the technology. And it basically, after, at this point, we just go into mayhem ensues, lots of cars and guns and broken hearts and a happy ending, relatively.
Well, yeah, I definitely write with a lot of adrenaline, or I guess octane in this case. My books tend to be, you know, very lean. They end up on the shorter side. I think part of that, you know, comes from not only my own sort of impatience with ponderous writing and just my willingness to cut to the chase, as it were. But I think, you know, my day job as an editor, I'm looking at footage all day from TV shows and mostly, you know, nonfiction, like documentary stuff. And so my whole brain is wired to trim the fat and to get to the point and to cut out anything that's unnecessary. And so I think that is just sort of how my storytelling sensibility is wired. So definitely, if you're looking for fast-paced and aggressive crime fiction, then my books are for you.
And another one of the Anthony nominees, John Shepherd, who also works in the film industry, said some similar things about the storytelling aspect of it.
Yeah, and I know John well, and he's a film director and you know, writer, and I think having started in screenplays, you know, John and I have talked about this because I was a screenwriter for a number of years, and nothing ever made it to the screen, unfortunately, as so often happens in this town. But you know, I wrote 18 feature-length screenplays and just, you know, some TV pilots and stuff. And I think just that training to be able to tell a complete story with a beginning, middle, and end, and to do that effectively in, you know, a 90-minute or a two-hour run time, it's both good exercise for trimming the fat, as I say, but I think it's also a great example of you can tell a complete story. You don't need 800 pages to tell a story that is satisfying from a narrative point of view and has real relationships and has developing characters, story arcs, and all that kind of stuff. So I think for the people that sort of look down their nose at shorter works, whether it's, you know, novellas that are, come in at 25,000 words or just short novels at, you know, 40,000, like Postman Always Rings Twice or something like that, I mean, those are just as satisfying to me as Don Winslow's The Force, you know.
So Leadfoot, I could see it on a wire spinner rack in the drugstore back in the day.
All I've ever wanted to be, Terry, is a pulp hack. If I could just crank out 3 or 4 novels a year and just have them be sitting on that spinner rack, oh, I was born in the wrong time. I should have been writing pulp novels in the 50s for Gold Medal, and I would have been happy as a clam.
And my day job is I actually work in antiques and collectibles, and I will come across books or boxes of those pulp novels. And let me tell you, they're still extremely strong on the secondary market. So there's obviously a taste for them.
Oh, yeah. I'm sitting in my office right now, and I have an entire little shelf that I built to house my pulp paperbacks. I've probably got, you know, 300 paperbacks here, you know, the originals. And I really, really do my best to go back and read the origins of crime and pulp fiction. I mean, not only that they're great books, and I found so many of my absolute favorite books were written 50, 60 years ago, but they really are timeless in a way. I mean, there are a couple of things. I mean, obviously, you know, people are not using cell phones, and
sure.
You know, the PIs are a lot more misogynist, and thankfully some of those things have changed. But, you know, from a story point of view, and for just like having a short sort of punch to the gut and a great read, I mean, you can't beat them, and they don't age the same way that, you know, music does, or I think, or films do sometimes. I think they're a lot more timeless on the page.
And I'll agree with you on that one, because growing up, I mean, I liked pulp romances. And someone asked me, you know, what writers influenced me. I'll always say, well, one of my influences was Barbara Cartland. And they'll kind of look at me, you know, I'll start getting the stink eye, and I go, you know what? That old biddy sold a billion books with a B. And if you go through them, and once as I became a little bit more trained with a writer's eye, if you'll go through them, they're about 25 to 30,000 words long. The acts turn on a dime. I can take one at random and open it up to about a quarter of the page count, and the first act will turn within 2 or 3 pages in either side of that spot. And that made them, they worked. You know, they were like potato chips. You always knew what you were going to get when you opened up the bag. And there's something to be said for that. So I'll let you know if I come across a good box of nice, clean, pulpy crime novels, because that's the sort of thing I find out here in the great Midwest.
Oh, yeah. Believe me, I keep hoping that there's some stash in some relative's attic that I have yet
to discover.
Oh, there
is. I went to my late husband and I, when we were doing the business together, we went to an auction at a family that had run a car dealership for, you know, pretty much as long as there had been cars. The auction itself ran 2 rings for 10 hours straight. Because they had basically not thrown anything away for the last 75 years.
Oh, man.
it was amazing. It was absolutely an absolutely amazing sale. So yeah, that's one thing the Midwest does very well. So now to kind of turn this, because we're just talking about you like writing all this pulpy mayhem. Tell me about Unloaded.
Well, yeah, Unloaded. Yeah, it's a collection of stories. They're all crime and mystery stories. But the stipulation is that there are no guns in the stories, either on the page or off. There's no referencing them. They're just not present in the story at all. And when I conceived of this idea originally, because I have opinions about guns, and especially guns in America, and, I'm not one to want to overturn the Second Amendment. I don't want to come into your house and take your guns. And but I am very interested in a much more reasoned and logical debate about the issue than we seem to be capable of having in this country. So with so many mass shootings, of course, which grabbed the headlines, a couple years ago, we had a run where there were like three in a row that were just, they were tragic and they were seemed so avoidable if there were just these common sense gun laws. And mm-hmm. I found myself going on Twitter like so many other people and saying something angry and just venting my frustration. And finally I thought, well, it's kind of not enough anymore. I want to do something. And as small of a gesture as this is, at least it's something, and it made me feel as if I was doing something. Because the other half of this equation is I had to take a long look at myself and say, okay, I have these opinions about guns and what damage I think they do to society and to innocent people. But I write about guns all the time, and I write, violent mayhem about guns. So am I part of the problem? I found that there were a lot of like-minded writers who were both having the same struggles that I was with this issue. So I started sending out a couple of selected emails to people that I knew very definitively would line up politically with me on this issue, because it is the kind of thing where if you open that up to someone who has a difference of opinion, it can very often turn ugly. So once I started getting enthusiastic yeses to being a part of this project, I knew I was onto something. So it ended up being 24 authors in that first collection, and all the proceeds we donated and continue to donate to a nonprofit organization that works to try to pass common sense gun legislation. And I'm really proud of the book and really gratified that it got this Anthony nomination, both just sort of as validation for the hard work that went into it and for a little higher profile for the book and therefore more money to the cause. And I just last week turned in the final collection for Unloaded Volume 2, which will be out early next year.
I saw that, and congratulations on that. I can't wait to see what everyone turns up with in volume two. Well, and it goes to the old saw that all art is political.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as art that as a matter of fact, if it doesn't have some sort of a statement about it, it's hollow. It has no soul. Even the most amusing, mayhem-filled romp is going to have some sort of social statement to it.
Yeah. I think it was very important to me as I was laying out the rules, as loose as they were, for this collection. When I was approaching people, I said very specifically, like, look, I don't want an anti-gun story. I don't want some political screed. I just want to do something where the guns are conspicuously absent, but you still get this entertaining story. You still get all the beats of excitement and thrills and violence in other forms, if that's what you're in for.
Mm-hmm.
But then in a very, admittedly, a very, very small way, but a token gesture, but it felt like doing something. It's a way of saying, hey, look, we took the guns out of the equation and the thing didn't fall apart. The world didn't end. The story's still there. Maybe in a perfect world, we can do this with our real lives. Maybe we don't need the guns as much as we think we need them. So it was just, you know, trying to be a jumping off point for the discussion.
And you took some flack for it too, didn't you?
Honestly, not nearly as much as I thought I would. I was fully prepared, and still am. I mean, I think in a way, we probably should be targeting, sending out arcs to more right wing, to the NRA or something like that to try to fan the flames a little bit, because there's no such thing as bad press, as they say. But we definitely, the first three reviews that went up on Amazon were all 1-star reviews. They all went up in the same day, and it was pretty clear that no one had actually read the stories involved.
Yes.
But they had an agenda and they wanted to make a statement. But thankfully after that it was pretty quiet, and I did not get to the other side of the debate's credit, I think there's more reason out there in America than we've been led to believe, because
yes,
it's, as so often happens, the people with the loudest voice dominate the conversation on both sides, absolutely on both sides. So it was gratifying that it didn't end up in a shouting match. I was actually really happy about that.
I just remember when one of the small kerfuffles broke out and some of the writers who were in it, who are, bona fide tough guys, are just kind of like going, what the fuck? It's like, what is your problem? And it was funny. It was just very, very funny. So who are some of the writers in volume two?
Volume two is another 24, or I think I may have ended up with 23 because I had a late dropout, unfortunately. But some amazing writers, just sort of off the top of the order here, is we got Chris Holm, Laura McHugh, her novels The Weight of Blood and Arrowwood are fantastic. Everyone should read those. James Ziskin, Bill Kreider gave me a story, which I was thrilled about because I love Bill. He's a legend. A lot of writers who maybe, might not think of, for, I guess, being political or anything like that. I mean, Laurie Rader Day, John Rector. I got some people from across the pond for the first time. Jay Stringer and Steve Kavanaugh both gave stories.
Excellent.
So it's actually really fascinating to see what these people come up with when you give them a stipulation like no guns, because it's just wild what you get. I mean, there's literally, in the first collection, it was like, okay, no guns. So what did we end up getting? Well, there's, there's a murderous clown who may or may not be the figment of some guy's imagination. And you just sort of go off the deep end. And in this one too, it's like you've got, there's a story with a cat in it that you sort of get this almost a cozy kind of thing. And then there's one where there's a monkey on the loose. You've got, a punk rock show. It's really fantastic. The other thing that I have in volume two that is really unique and different, a writer named Ed Amar wanted to, express his interest in contributing. And I know that he had been through something in his real life where his son's daycare, and I think his son was two and a half at the time, someone fired a bullet through the window of his son's daycare. And
my goodness.
So he had to get, everyone was fine. No one got hurt. It was just sort of this random act, but he had to get this phone call saying, hey, listen, just want to let you know, here's what happened. Everything's fine. And I knew that this had happened to him because I saw him talk about it on social media. So when he approached me and said, hey, I'd really love to contribute his story, I said, hey, would you consider writing a nonfiction piece about your experience? And he did. So it breaks the rule in a way, because there's obviously a gun in the story, but I thought it was an important story in terms of you know, how random this was, and it really does, I think, drive home the "it could happen to you" sort of aspect of gun violence. And at this point, you know, we all know enough people. We're very close. We're probably not more than two or three people away from somebody who's been affected in some way by gun violence. So that was important for me to have a story like that, a true story like that, in this collection.
No, that'll be amazing. I know Ed, or I know him on social media, and I know that's just going to be amazing, an amazing story to read. And I understand where you're at. Through Pam Stack, the executive producer of Authors on the Air, she is chairing an anthology that's going to benefit a domestic violence organization. It's called Betrayed. We just turned all the stories in last week. And the same thing, it's not going to be preachy stories about domestic violence, but every story in it's going to have that as a thread that ties it together. And I've read a bunch of them, and they're the same thing. They're as varied. They're all, you know, one you swear it could almost have the name Harlequin Romance on it. And others are very, very tense and murderous and everything else. Mine is a compilation of bits and pieces from real cases I worked on when I was with Legal Aid, just little details that have stuck in my head all these years. Yeah, toilet paper roses, just the three words right there. And so I turn mine. Mine's a little bit more straight up legal thriller. So that's that same thing of just how varied, by just using that one thread with the caveat that you can't get preachy.
Yeah.
And now just go roll with it from there.
Well, I have further proof that the crime writers, for all the darkness that lurks in our heads, are always some of the kindest and most generous people out there. You know, I know Thomas Pluck, who contributed a story to the first Unloaded, is a great writer. He's compiled a couple of anthologies called Protectors that, you know, benefit organizations that help child abuse and things like that. I mean, there are so many writers out there who are going to be generous and kind with their words, which is, you know, in my introductions for Unloaded, I mean, I liken it to, that's our weapon of choice is our words.
Yes. And
if that's all we have, then that's what we're going to use.
And that's an interesting phrase that you used, because here in my town of Fort Scott, Kansas, this is actually the birthplace of the life photographer Gordon Parks and filmmaker.
Yeah.
And he grew up here basically during Jim Crow, and he left a very angry young man, as he rightfully should have. And his weapon of choice became his camera.
Yeah.
And here at our little small local college, which has become a repository of his papers and everything, every year they give out what they call the Weapon of Choice Award, which goes to a photographer, a filmmaker, an actor, someone who tells this story, uses something about their talent and their career to tell the story, typically of racism in America. And it's pretty amazing. For just, we're a map dot, and we're the epicenter of the national award. You know, so that was an interesting choice of words that you gave. And just across the board, I enjoy themed anthologies that still allow for a lot of creativity. On the flip side, oh, go ahead, please.
Well, no, I just was gonna. I've been so fortunate to be invited into so many great anthologies in the last couple of years. It's really, they're so much fun when you get the assignment. Like, oh, write a story based on a song by the Replacements. Yes, absolutely, I will do that. It's a great jumping off point for stimulating ideas.
Well, I am emerald green with envy that you are in the Springsteen anthology. Which song did you pick? I don't remember which one you picked.
I picked it was up all night or open all night. I always confuse the two. It's so funny when you know Joe Clifford asked me to contribute a story, and I of course jumped at the chance. And that story it's a little out there. I tried to do something different, like structurally with it, because I think short stories is where you can kind of play around a little bit. You can stretch, you know, flex the muscles, and it's good practice. So I turned in this story, and he said he liked it and accepted it. And then all of a sudden I started to notice, like, oh, this collection is actually going to be kind of a big deal. Maybe I should have played it a little more straight. no one's complained, so I guess that's good.
Well, and I can say, too, that anthology is how I got to know Joe. I'm not in it. I wasn't on Joe's radar at that time, but it's how I came to know Joe Clifford and some of the rest of you, too, because I am a super fan. So, of course, I was absolutely fascinated by it. And are you in the Johnny Cash anthology?
I'm not in the Johnny Cash. I did the Replacements. I was in one called Mama Tried, which was about based on outlaw country songs, and there will be a forthcoming anthology inspired by songs from the Go-Go's that I'll be in. But I think that doesn't hit until 2019. I think that's still a ways off.
Well, I'm just beside myself when Joe gave me a late inning invite into the Johnny Cash anthology, because that's, you know, that's what I was raised on.
Yeah, that's great.
And
what song did you pick?
I picked Man in Black.
Oh,
and I turned it basically into a tale of vigilantism.
Always a good way to go.
Absolutely. And I can say too that Danny Gardner's story in there is just, it just blew me and it blew me right out of the water. It's incredible. So that one should be, the galleys are done. We don't have an absolute release date, but it should be shortly.
When that one comes out.
Danny's
story is the one that, I think that's the one he read at Noir at the Bar in New York City last month for Thriller Fest. I think that's the story. Now, if it's the same story, yes, it was quite powerful.
The touch that he has with dialogue is just absolutely incredible. So tell me about these noir at the bars.
Yeah, I've been running the Los Angeles chapter of Noir at the Bar for, good grief, 6 years now. We are the second oldest chapter nationwide, and because it's spread like a virus now. It originally started for me. There was a bookstore here in Los Angeles called the Mystery Bookstore, and it was where I was able to go for signings, and you know they would do parties, and they would sponsor a booth at the LA Times Festival of Books and these things. So right as I was getting started, I did my first ever book signing there for my first novel, and I just got to meet so many other writers and talk to them and you know go to their events. And when that closed down, all of a sudden there was a very noticeable vacuum in the LA crime scene, and I wasn't seeing my peers anymore, and I wasn't able to ask advice and you know get the information that I was getting before. So I had known that Scott Phillips and Jedediah Ayers out of St. Louis had been doing this thing called Noir at the Bar. So they'd already been doing it for a year and a half, 2 years at that point. And so I emailed them and I said, hey, do you guys mind if I do this in LA? I think we really need it out here. And they gave their blessing. And actually, they were the ones who informed me that it had started a couple years before they did it in Philadelphia. A guy named Peter Rosofsky had done his version of it for, you know, he only did a few of them and then it kind of died out. But so the brilliance of the alliterative name started in Philadelphia with Peter, and then Scott and Jed picked it up. And then when I decided that I wanted to do it and started doing it here in LA, I think as soon as it became a franchise, if you will, then a lot of other people, you know, Todd Robinson started doing one in New York City, and then bing, bang, boom, it's just all over the country. And now they've done a couple in England. They've done some in Australia. So it's really spread like wildfire because I think the main reason is that it's so much more fun than just a bookstore reading, and it's so much more casual. And the big thing, it was always it's a social event first, and it's, you know, a book selling event way second. So I wanted a place where I could invite my crime writer friends and people that love reading crime fiction and mystery fiction, give them a place to come see five or six writers in one night read their stuff, hopefully hear some new voices that you've never heard, and you think, oh, I got to check this person out, or oh, I want to buy their book, see some people that you love and get a book signed, you know, all that stuff, all wrapped around just a social event, just a night out to hang with your friends. So it's been really gratifying in that sense to give people that hub of activity, and you know, and we've had so many readers who've done their very first readings with us, which is really neat. And then a lot of them, when we have them back, you know, a year or 2 years later, and they've got their debut novels out. So it's been a really exciting thing to see.
That's fantastic. We were talking, I'm not going to be at BoucherCon this year. I just couldn't make it to Toronto, although I may be doing a remote broadcast from there. But I'm going to be in Florida with bells on. And Pam is already talking about that we have to have a down and out noir at the bar in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting that now I've done sort of the road shows a couple of times, you know, from BoucherCons here and there, and it's interesting to try to plan it from 3,000 miles away. So like in Toronto, I'm not doing one because some of the local guys, Rob Brunette and Tanis Mallow, sort of emailed me. They said, hey, we're thinking we have a bar, we know a place. Would you want us to help out? And I was like, oh my gosh, it's all yours. You handle it. I've tried booking a bar from the other side of the country and no, thank you. You can take it.
And hopefully it'll become hopefully they can turn it into a regular thing too. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I'm always, anytime I see one of them come up, cause they're fairly popular in Seattle as well.
Yeah. Well, and it's tough sometimes if you're in a smaller market. I mean, in L.A., you know, we have an embarrassment of riches as far as people who are right here in town. And then we try whenever we can to book a date around a touring author. Like if I know someone is going to be out and about with their book, you know, oh, Johnny Shaw is coming down from Portland, he's going to make a stop at a bookstore in San Diego, but there's no bookstores left in LA practically. So I'll say, hey, you want to come have a reading? And you know, across the board, everyone who comes out to Noir at the Bar, all the authors from out of town, they're always so grateful because, you know, as you know, if you show up at a bookstore, especially if you're from out of town, and unless you're a big best-selling author, obviously, mm-hmm. like if you get five or a half dozen people there, that's a good night. I'm providing a place where we routinely get 30, 40 people there.
So absolutely.
It's a
you wouldn't be able to
night.
Keep me away from them.
You'd be one of our regulars, huh?
Absolutely. It's great. Like you said, hey, it's beer and books and writers all in the same place. What's not to love?
Exactly.
So how often are they?
Well, we end up doing it about every 3 months. We do probably 4 a year. We've done five, but sometimes it does take work. And now I keep adding things to my to-do list. You know, like now doing the podcast and all that stuff. I am a boy who can't say no, much to my detriment, and hopefully not to the detriment of my marriage, but sometimes it feels like that. But I tend to do too much. So
hey, it's fun, and it's fun. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, I'm probably going to be coming your way sometime in the spring, and trust me, I'm going to ask you if you have one scheduled, and if I can, I will schedule my trip so that if I possibly can, I can hit the event because they just look like so much fun.
We'll make it happen.
For sure. So you are You're now with, I've got here, did Down and Out pick up your entire catalog or just part of it?
When my previous publisher went under, they had orphaned five novels, mm-hmm. one of which that had yet to come out. So the two McGraw books and then three in another series, the Lars and Shane series, the third of which was about only a month away from coming out when they closed their shutters and waved goodbye. Down and Out, Eric Campbell was kind enough to swoop in within 24 hours of that news hitting the internet and offered to put out all those books. So that's incredibly generous of him. And the two McGraw books are back out in the world now, and then the Lars and Shane, the entire trilogy will hit in early next year, in April of next year. So it'll be a re-release of the first two books that had been out there, and then the third book will finally land. And that trilogy has been through the ringer because it's had two different publishers die underneath it, because the first book came out with one publisher, they died, and I had already written the second book. So the second book sat written and untouched for, I think, 3 years. It's been a long, hard road for those books. I'm so glad that they finally are going to get out there, because honestly, it's some of my best work. I love those books, but they've just gotten such the short shrift. I feel so bad for Lars and Shane.
Have you given any thought that it might be you?
I have given a lot of thought to. I believe me. I warned Eric Campbell. I said, "Look, you just know if you're getting in business with me, I have this track record." There is one through line through all these different publishers dying, and it's me. Believe me, I know. I've warned. I warned Steve before the podcast. Oh man.
It's the nature of the beast. But I mean, Eric was out there with a basket, you know, just kind of scooping you guys up as they were, you know, as you were being dropped through the trap door, because he's a smart guy and he took the chance to sign these incredible books into Down and Out. What is Criminal Economics?
Criminal Economics is a novel of mine that, again, Down and Out picked up just recently. And it was one that I wrote. I write a lot, and some would say too much. So it was a novel that I had completed with my previous agent. He was out shopping. We had just placed Devil Doesn't Want Me, I think, the first in the Lars and Shane. He was shopping Rum Runners. Basically, I had too many books that he could service at one time. So Criminal Economics kind of fell through the cracks a little bit. I like the book. I know it's not a mainstream book. It's a little bit more gonzo. I'm sort of channeling my inner Victor Gishler, Dwayne Swarzynski. The people who've read it have really liked it, but it's not the kind of book you're going to give to your mother. It's a little extreme. But
after Angel Cologne's No Happy Endings, I don't think I can be shocked anymore.
There you go. It's a nice companion piece. But what I did with it originally was I said, oh, okay, I'm just going to try. I'm going to print up 100 of them and hand number and sign them all. And it's just going to be just for the dedicated readers. So it was a limited edition thing that I had because I didn't want it to go to waste. And I thought it would be something, you know, fine. I know that's the kind of thing, like, I enjoy that. I've got a bunch of, you know, Joe Lansdale books that are kind of signed one-offs and the below-the-radar books. So I went ahead and did that with Criminal Economics, and it was fun. And some people have some collector's items out there, for whatever that's worth. But then the book was still sort of sitting around. And when I was talking with Eric Campbell, you know, he had published a couple of my co-written books, and we were always talking about, you know, what to do next and what to do more. And then Criminal Economics, it's a long story, but it got picked up as an ebook by another publisher in Europe, but there was no print edition here. Campbell offered to do the print edition. I said, okay, enough time has passed. Yeah, let's do it. So now Criminal Economics is finally back out in the world. And again, it's a book that I love and I have a real soft spot for, but I hope the right audience continues to find it. And certainly it's the kind of thing where if you read one of my books and you say, oh, I like that, there's plenty for you to choose from should you choose to go back to the well.
Yes, your list is impressive, sir. I have to compliment you on that.
Well, you know, writers write. It's what we do. So I just sort of keep typing and try not to overwhelm my agents. My current agent, I think she was sitting on three full manuscripts, like three completed novels. And then when I had a meeting with her not too long ago in New York, I sort of mentioned, like, well, and then there's that other book I haven't even sent you. And she was like, what? I said, oh, yeah, no, I have a whole novel that you haven't even seen yet because I don't want to overwhelm you.
So your agent basically is looking at you going, you know, oh, my God, it's another email from Eric. Oh, God, it's got an attachment. No.
Exactly. She's like, slow down,
kid. She wants you to get a dog or something like that, right? No,
I'm a very impatient boy, you might notice.
Well, no, and you've hit your sweet spot in that that pulp, you know, not 600 pages of ponderous literary fiction or 47 pages of tedious technical details. Just telling these rapid fire stories, like you said, in what you edit in the documentaries and other. Is that primarily what you work in, or documentaries?
I mean, unscripted television. I'll say that. So it's a mix mm-hmm. of heady documentaries that no one's ever seen, and then cheesy reality shows that everyone knows about that sometimes you don't necessarily want to mention at a cocktail party.
Aha! I enjoy cheesy reality shows, so that's not a problem. That's not a problem at all. A couple of weeks ago, I got to talk to Mike Cole, who was one of the hunters on Hunted, CBS's Hunted.
Oh yeah.
That was one of my favorite reality shows ever, especially as a lawyer and a crime writer. Watching Hunted was just great. It's like, no, don't do that. Don't use your Bluetooth. They're going to hack it. And haven't you ever read any Barry Eisler? But again, you've managed to hit that sweet spot of length and pacing. And there are way worse things in the world than overwhelming your agent with manuscripts. That's hilarious. And Steve was telling me the other night about writer types. It really sounds like you guys are almost taking a cheesy reality show approach to your podcast.
Well, I think the touchstone for us is really more like a variety show. I think, you know, there were enough podcasts out there that had, you know, like this format where you get a more of an in-depth conversation. So we wanted to try to do something that was a little different, just to try to stand out a little bit. And I think because I have the access and the ability to edit and, you know, it's always in my interest to trim the fat. So I said, well, let's, you know, if we do this, let's record them and then I'm going to edit them and make everyone sound smarter than they are and just sort of keep things moving. So we've ended up with this show that, you know, we'll interview three or four authors over the course of an episode. Plus we have a book review section. Plus we do a lot of short stories, have someone come in and read their work. Plus we've done, we do these little segments we call the unpanel, where we'll take three writers and sometimes more and ask everyone the same question, and sort of you get a couple different takes on something from different authors. And so you end up with a show that, you know, they've all come in like around probably about 45 minutes, but within that time frame,
wow,
it moves really fast. And, you know, there's music breaks in between. And then of course, in between all the segments, Steve and I are in there talking and we're bantering back and forth, and, you know, we think we're so funny, and so we try to keep it light and moving. So, just try to sort of occupy a slightly different space in the podcast world.
No, it sounds great. When I was given the opportunity to do this show, she asked me to pitch it. And within the network, there are quite a few specialty shows, you know, horror, thriller, noir, et cetera. But I read all of that. So I said, well, I want to do multi-genre. I want to talk to whoever sounds interesting to me. And that's where I came up with the – I'm also an insane collector of restaurant china.
Oh, wow.
I know. How am I still single? I agree. So that's where I came up with the idea of this is basically the coffee shop and you never know who's going to be on the menu, the Blue Plate Special.
Right.
And I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm probably going to be expanding it a little bit, doing some special shows on alternative media, comic books, web comics. I'm very good friends with someone who's in DreamWorks and has worked on 12 of the big DreamWorks movies, and have him come in and talk about storytelling and animation, because it all just interests me. So I'm the same thing. I'm a 10-year-old kid when it's like, oh my gosh, I want to do this and I want to do that and I want to do this. So I'm definitely looking forward to it too. So basically,
it's all
right now,
storytelling at the end of the day, right?
Yes. So where you're at right now is you're at BoucherCon Toronto. You're nominated in paperback original and best anthology.
Yep.
And that's for Leadfoot and for Unloaded, correct?
Yep. Fingers crossed.
Your partner Steve is in novella, in the novella category.
Right.
Along with about half of the rest of the Down and Out writers. So I think you're going to be spared the dance-off in the novella category. But Steve is toast in that one. It's just amazing, because what that shows, too, is Down and Out's dedication to the format and the genre. They don't give those nominations away. You know, you all had to work through the slog. So I have my fingers crossed for basically all of you, which makes it really awkward because
rooting for a five-way tie. How about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. You've also got the podcast. How often is Writer Types?
We do once a month because it's so much work.
Yes.
All we can handle.
Mine are typically going to be once a week. This was just Pam said, I really want a vacation. Do you want all my broadcast slots? And I'm like, okay, I'm new.
Take it.
So three times a week. It's been really intense and really fun. I mean, I talked, you know, about George Romero and anthologies with John and Joe Ledger with Jonathan Mayberry the other night. Monday is Chris Holm. You know, it's just fantastic. I'm just like a kid in a candy store. I want to talk to you, and I want to talk to you, and I want to talk to you. So it'll be a great time going through. Thank you for coming on tonight. I definitely appreciate it. I'll keep an eye on what you're writing. I can't have you on for every new novel, or there wouldn't be anybody else, because
right.
You're such a, you know, manuscript machine. But no, seriously, when you are there going to be any more McGraw books?
I don't know. It's one of those things where I'm always so far out ahead that if I decide to take time to write another one, if it means putting other stuff on hold. But I love the McGraws, and they seem to have struck a chord with people. So I'm leaning very much towards that. And Eric Campbell from Down and Out and I have a bet that if Leadfoot wins the Anthony Award, I am obligated then to write another one.
Ooh. Well, I'll just say, or when you get a new series loaded up or whatever, please let me know, because this has been great, and I want to keep track of what you're doing and what you and Steve are doing with the podcast. So I'll say goodnight to you and thank you. I've got a couple little housekeeping announcements I have to make, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And if you enjoyed this show, well, support for this broadcast came from Down and Out Books, celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction. You can check them out at www.downandoutbooks.com. And this podcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. You can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to keep up with who's going to be on the menu every week. And at that point, I will say goodnight to everybody and thank you for tuning in.